waste when it's returned to the UK and will investigate if laws were broken by the commercial company that shipped the waste to Brazil. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Two American service members have been killed in a bomb blast in southern Afghanistan, bringing the death toll among U.S. troops in that country to 37 in July, the deadliest month of the war so far. An 8-year-old victim of alleged gang rape is in child protective custody in Phoenix after her parents shunned her, saying she had brought shame on her family. Police cited the family's Liberian refugee background as a reason, saying the stigma of rape still endures in many parts of Africa and among refugees in the U.S. The girl was allegedly lured by a group of boys ages 9 to 14 behind a shed where police say she was raped. All the boys have been charged, the eldest as an adult. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Guitarist Rodney Jones has played with more jazz, blues, pop, and R&B artists than I can mention in 25 seconds. He's in Urbana this weekend for a series of workshops and seminars and will play live for us on the Friday edition of Live and Local. Also live with us, flutist Rebecca Johnson, who teaches at Eastern Illinois University in Charleston. It's Live and Local weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
WILO programs are made possible in part by Bevere Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plots on the U of I campus.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, hour number 2. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In 1610, the English explorer Henry Hudson set out on his fourth attempt to find a direct water route from Europe to East Asia. In what's now known as Hudson's Bay, his ship became icebound, and after sitting out the winter there, Hudson's crew turned against him, putting him, his son, and seven others in a small boat and casting them adrift. Well, at least that's one version of what happened. What we do know is they were never seen again, and their fate is uncertain. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the final expedition of Henry Hudson. And our guest is Peter Mankell, and he's written a book about this that's just recently been published. The title of his book is Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson. Basic Books is the publisher. Our guest is professor of history and anthropology at the University of Southern California. He's also the director of the USC Huntington Early Modern Studies Institute, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions are welcome. We just ask people to keep their questions brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody who's listening can join us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, use the local number. If it would be a long-distance call, use the other one. And we'd be very, very happy to have your comments and questions. Professor Mankell, hello.
Hello. How are you today?
I am fine, thanks. How are you?
Just fine, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
I think just the basic thing I'm supposed to understand here at the beginning, if people don't, is that what it is that drove Hudson and others was the very same thing that drove Columbus. That is, people wanted to find a quicker, more direct way to get from Western Europe to East Asia.
That is exactly right. I mean, by the time of Columbus, and then obviously also the time of Hudson, Europeans had fallen absolutely in love with these spices, you know, spices that we take completely for granted today, but spices which came to them primarily from the Spice Islands of the Southwest Pacific and other trade that they might be able to get from East Asia. And so Columbus, we all know very famously, you know, sets off, you know, to the west to get to the east, and we know what happens with that. Mm-hmm. And then over the course of the century, Europeans are still trying to find the best way to do that. And by the time Hudson comes on the scene, the dominant way of doing that was to sail south out of Europe, around Africa, around India, to the Spice Islands and back, a very long and expensive journey. And so Hudson thought, well, these spices are so desirable, I need to find a quicker way to go. Looked at a map and thought the northern routes would make the most sense. But underlying it was really this obsession for spices, not just to sort of make food more palatable, but also because, as you know, we all could speculate, Europeans at the time didn't bathe as frequently, and so spices were used in various perfumes to improve the smells of people and places. But most important, I think, spices to Europeans had great medicinal benefits. And so if they could get a hold of these spices while they were fresh, bring them back, in Hudson's case, bring them back to England, they might find cures for all sorts of bodily ailments. And yeah. So there was all sorts of economic inspiration for them to do this.
I think that that's an interesting thing for people to appreciate, because I think that everyone has heard this canard, and I'm not really sure that it's true, that the reason that they were so interested in spices was because the food was rotten and they needed to cover that up. I think that their interest in these things, as you say, was much more multifaceted and more complicated. They did have medicinal applications. They certainly had culinary applications. There were all sorts of things that people did with these. And as you say, now when we know, well, you can go down to the grocery store and you can relatively cheaply, you can buy all the pepper you want.
Right.
You can
right.
buy cloves. You can buy cinnamon. You can buy as much of this as you want, and we use them casually and carelessly, that it's hard to put yourself in the frame of mind of these people where something like that was so rare and so valuable that you'd go to the extent that these explorers did to try to find a quicker, easier way to get to the place where they have this stuff.
That is exactly right. And, you know, there are these wonderful herbals from 16th and early 17th century English herbals. I mean, there are other Europeans also, but Hudson presumably knows the English ones. And they, you know, will have sort of a line drawing, of engraving of what a spice looks at. It'll tell you where it's found. And then many times they will just list all of the benefits of specific spices. And, in fact, you know, improving the taste of food, though we know they used it for that and they appear in cookbooks, was not what the herbals emphasized. I mean, the herbals really emphasized, you know, the health benefits. You know, if you could consume cloves, it could both, you know, it could help clear up your eyesight, and it could, as they put it, strengthen a weak brain. You know, if you had heartburn, you should put some mace, you know, in something that you were eating. Nutmeg could cure urinary tract infections. It could help you fall asleep if you had insomnia. And then, you know, you mentioned peppers. I mean, peppers were sort of the greatest of the spices, the ones that they talked about really endlessly. If you could consume peppers, it would break a fever. It could stop coughing. It could cure gout or sciatica, headaches, tonsillitis. If you had worms, you know, peppers might get rid of them. If you had sores from a bout of leprosy, peppers could get rid of them. I mean, these really sort of basic things, and so the spices were perfect. And then Hudson, just to add a little twist to this, part of the trick with these spices was getting them when they were as fresh as possible. And so if there was a way for Hudson to get to the Southwest Pacific more quickly and get back again, he could, or his company could, essentially market these as fresher spices than those that had made the much longer journey along the more traditional routes, either via water, you know, around India and Africa and then up to Europe, or overland, you know, using the old Silk Road. And so there was really a very specific economic thing. And then one of the things which is fascinating about the documents from the period is we all know that in the 16th century, Christendom becomes divided after the Protestant Reformation. So we have Catholics on one side and Protestants on the other side. And we know that there were battles fought and all sorts of terrible consequences, you know, that lasted for centuries. But when you get into the herbals themselves and some of these books, you realize that people are arguing that the English need to get over to the Spice Islands in part so they could advance the cause of Protestantism by basically saying, look, it's Protestants who are bringing this to you. You don't need those Catholics to bring you spices anymore. And so it gets caught up in all this religious drama as well.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Peter Mancall, he's professor of history and anthropology at University of Southern California and is author of the book Fatal Journey. It is about the final expedition of Henry Hudson, and it's published by Basic Books. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We, I think, associate Hudson with this idea that there was a way to sail by water from starting out on one end of North America in the Atlantic, and that you could go by boat all the way across and come out in the Pacific. What I didn't know was that in his first couple of voyages, he was thinking about going the other way.
Exactly. In fact, his first three voyages, he's thinking about going the other way. So in 1607, you know, which I always tell my students is the year the English set up shop at Jamestown. In 1607, Hudson looks at his map and says, the quickest way to the Pacific is to go basically straight north across the North Pole. And he's reading a lot of geographers who have articulated a theory that the Arctic will be ice-free in the summertime because of the heat of the sun. So he heads straight north in 1607. It doesn't work. Ice drives him back home. 1608, he says, okay, I'm going to go over into the Northeast Passage. That's the passage north of Russia. This attempt had sort of a predecessor in Willem Barents, this Dutch explorer who tried to go there and, in fact, dies there in 1597. Hudson says, okay, I'm going to go through the Northeast Passage. That fails because he's blocked by ice. He comes home. 1609, the year of his most famous journey that we associate with him going to what is now New York and sailing up what is now the Hudson River, Hudson again tries to go through the Northeast Passage, this time working for the Dutch East India Company, gets blocked. They have a discussion on board the ship, and then they say, okay, let's sail across the Atlantic Ocean. There are a couple of possibilities. One is to head north, where the English explorer John Davis had gone in the 90s. And the other one, Hudson says, well, my friend Captain John Smith of Jamestown fame told me that the Indians of the Chesapeake, that is to us the Powhatan Indians, said that north of us there is this water route through the continent inland to a big body of water. And so Hudson again convinces his men to go look for that, and that's when he sails westward across the Atlantic Ocean for the first time.
Yeah.
Goes to New York and then comes back.
Given that, I'm sure that the territory we're talking about either way was very poorly charted, what made people think that you could actually do this?
Well, that is, you know, those are some of the great questions that I think all historians wrestle with. I mean, so starting, you know, with the time of Columbus, there are debates. European scholars are having debates about how big, you know, the world is. And Columbus, when Columbus sails off on his what becomes world-changing venture, he actually thinks the world is smaller than it turns out to be. By Hudson's time, people have a sense of the breadth of the Atlantic Ocean. There have been a lot of Europeans, especially European fishermen, sailing across the Atlantic over the course of the 16th century. And the maps that these people look at, that Hudson and others looked at, just presumed that there were these passages. I mean, there had been earlier reports that had come back, you know, some of the earlier reports of people sailing up the Pacific suggested, wait a minute, maybe there's a way through from here, that is from the Pacific, towards the Atlantic. And there are a number of people in the Atlantic who just believe that there must be a way through this continent. And a lot of it, you know, is sort of they want to believe that there's a passage through. And in the period before North America was charted in a way that Europeans understood, there's a lot of real speculation about what's out there. And so you'll often see in these maps from the 16th century, you know, this very clever device where they'll sort of chart what they know, and then they'll put a lot of words, you know, a part of the map that they don't quite know what it looks like. And you could sort of say, oh, maybe there's a passage through there, like literally covering up the edge of their knowledge with text. And so there is this constant speculation. And so one of the things that Hudson tries to do, and everyone who tries to find the Northwest Passage tries to do, they try to find a point where if they've traveled somewhere into North America, they can begin to see a shift in tides. That if the water starts coming from the west, that is, instead of coming from the Atlantic, they'll say to themselves, aha, we've sort of reached this point where we have proof that we can go on. And so his journals and other journals are filled with these comments about tides. you know, in ways that, you know, they're not very literary, they're not very flourish, you know, not great flourishes, but they're these very detailed, what is the tide doing today? Have we found that point where we can get through?
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Let's talk with someone in the community of Belgium, not too far away here. That's line number four. Hello.
Interesting occurrence. You're no longer on the airways, but I can hear you on the phone. Now you come back. That's weird. Anyway, to get onto the question that I have, at this point, scholars would have known the general breadth of the Earth. I mean, there was approximately 24,000 miles around. They kind of had an idea of that. And they knew Greenwich they considered as one meridian. They knew there was one that's 180 degrees out. Well, the islands they were going to were pretty much 180 degrees out. So it just kind of baffles my mind that, wait a minute, if you're on one half going around and the other half, you're still going halfway around the Earth either direction. And if the one that was open, okay, the Atlantic direction, there was no continents at all in the way, you'd still make pretty much the same length of distance, wouldn't you? Pretty close?
As opposed to going eastward, you mean?
As opposed to going to eastward.
Well, I think there is a sense. I mean, part of it is, part of what these people are trying to calculate, you know, in the 16th and early 17th century is not just the distance. I mean, I think your question, you know, is an excellent, excellent question about distance and about sort of general cartographic knowledge of the world. When you get into their texts from the time, they're not just sort of saying how far is it to this place, but they're asking themselves, can I make it there? That is, will I find people who are friendly, who will provision me along the way? And, you know, Columbus's men, you know, basically are about to mutiny on him in 1492 because he's sailed beyond the point where he thought they would find people. And so they don't just want to go into open sea because they're not really equipped to go, you know, 8,000-9,000 miles in open sea. They need to find people who are going to help them. And there's been a big discussion. By the time Hudson is coming up, there's a big discussion in European legal circles about what sort of relationships Europeans can claim to have with these non-European peoples. It really starts with the Portuguese, who will lay a claim to large swaths of the sea, you know, because they'd explored them. And then English lawyers come over and others, and Dutch lawyers come in, and they say, you can't own the sea. No one can own the sea, and you can't own these places. What you can have is treaties with various people. This is short of, you know, actual colonization. And so part of what's in Hudson's mind is, where can I go where I might be able to reprovision my ships? And so what's out there is very important. He knows North America is there. At the time he's sailing, you know, the English are set up at Jamestown. Jamestown is not doing very well at the time, but the people in England don't really know much detail about that. But they know that it's there. They know that the Cartier has gone to what is now, you know, the St. Lawrence. They know that various people have gone. So he knows there's stuff there. So the trick isn't just conquering the distance. It's figuring out how to survive as you conquer that distance. So
thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Hudson, as you earlier explained, tried to find this northeast passage, that is to go up and to go around the top of Russia to
right.
get to East Asia. He tried that three times, 16, 7, 8, and 9. And
right.
then it was in 9 that, not having succeeded in that, then he said, okay, let's turn around and go the other way. Then he went west. He sailed across the Atlantic in and into what is now Hudson's Bay and up what is now the Hudson River. Then,
well, he's not in Hudson's Bay. He's in, you know, he's in New York Harbor, and then he goes up Hudson River.
And he goes up the Hudson River. And I guess it was in the 1610 trip. That was when he ended up in
exactly.
Hudson's Bay. And so I guess the question is, given his lack of success, one might ask, and given the fact that it would have been expensive to do this, why he continued to be able to find people who would spend the money to send him out.
Right. And that is such, you know, a great question. And because to us, you know, looking back now from the 21st century back, we say, wow, you know, by 1610, Hudson doesn't seem a very good bet. You know, he told us he could get across the pole in 07. That didn't work. He told us he could get through the Northeast Passage in 8 and 9. Those don't work. Why back him again in 1610? And my thinking on this is that though Hudson fails at achieving his goal, that is finding the quick way to the Spice Islands, let's say, in 1607 and in 1608, he returns to England with his ship intact and all of his crew intact. No one dies. You know, this, you know, Arctic ventures are incredibly dangerous, and no one dies on Hudson, and the ship is perfectly fine. 1609, now the Dutch have hired him. You know, he goes, and he goes up the Northeast Passage. That part goes well. Then he crosses the Atlantic. They do have skirmishes with the Munsees around modern New York, and a couple of people lose their lives, but the ship comes back. And even in 1610, you know, which he doesn't make it back, his ship, the Discovery, does. When a group of people, so Hudson is funded by three merchants principally, when people are funded to go overseas, the largest investment that anyone is making is in the ship, not in the personnel. Labor was very inexpensive because there was a surplus of population in England. There are a lot of young men hanging around the docks who, you know, basically just, you know, pick up the next job that comes along. I mean, there's a wonderful account of this, you know, Nathaniel Philbrick's In the Heart of the Sea, which, you know, was much later, and talks about the same sort of culture, this time in an American culture, about people, you know, young men going to sea because they have little option, they're skilled at it, and then going to sea doesn't enrich them in any way. I mean, because they keep being charged for food. The people who support Hudson, who provide the money for Hudson, think, we want that ship to come back. I mean, that's their real investment. And so Hudson fails to get to the Spice Islands. He does come back, and every time he comes back with an account, with a journal, and he is describing what is out there. And so even though the long-term goal, you know, he doesn't meet his long-term goal, he is bringing back new geographic information, and he's bringing back information about resources, especially Arctic resources. And he's bringing back information about where he saw whales, you know, where he saw seals, where an iceberg might topple a ship. I mean, this is very important information that others will build on. And in fact, the surviving documents for Hudson, virtually most of the surviving documents, the big narratives, are published by a man named Samuel Purchas in 1625, along with many other accounts of voyages into the Atlantic, and especially the North Atlantic, with the idea that the sum total of this information is going to be very helpful for others who plan ventures.
Mm. Well, that it's interesting. That it makes me think about the relative motivations of the people who would have been on this boat. Hudson, on one hand, thinking about the fact that fame and wealth could be his, depending right. on how things went. And then there were the sailors. It was just a job for them, and for them, probably the most important thing was coming back alive.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's hard to get at, you know, the motivations of a lot of these people, because some of them, other than sort of being listed as being a member of a crew of a ship, otherwise don't survive in historical record. But we do have this sort of sense that many of these were, you know, poor men. I mean, if we look at Hudson's ship, and we can whatever we can reconstruct, we have Hudson, who is, I think, fairly clearly, you know, has these very glorious ambitions in mind. And though he never said so, I sort of always imagined him thinking he'll be the next Francis Drake. You know, he will make the next great English accomplishment at sea. He's with his son. His son goes with him on every journey from starting when he's 14. So 14, 15, 16, and 17 when they set out on that, what becomes sort of the fatal journey. You know, he is there fairly clearly, I think, being groomed by Hudson to be the next person of this seafaring dynasty. There's a lot of speculation that Hudson comes from a family of people who are involved in overseas commerce. On board is a man named Thomas Widows, who is the ship's mathematician. And he is there sort of embodying this idea, which learned Europeans talked about at the time, which is the link between mathematics and navigational science. So he is there using whatever calculations he can make to sort of bring knowledge back. One of the mutineers, this man named Henry Green, is there. This is a guy who one of the documents tells us was formerly maybe successful in life, and then something happened, you know, and he lost his money, becomes a servant of Hudson and of others, and Hudson brings him along, you know, and then he ends up playing a pivotal role, you know, in the mutiny. And there are all these sorts of different little pieces, you know, that we put together. And then there are sort of the bulk of, and there's a ship surgeon, you know, who's there. And because all of these companies would have a surgeon on board to tend to the injuries that happen on any mission, to start to see maybe the early signs of scurvy and to do something about it. I mean, it's really interesting to sort of to think, you know, the different roles that, that these men, and they're all men on this ship, play in the journey.
We are at our midpoint. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge, and the guest is Peter Mancall. He's professor of history and anthropology at University of Southern California. He's director of the USC Huntington Early Modern Studies Institute and is the author of the recently published book, Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson, and it's published by Basic Books. It's a good story. It's out now in the bookstores, and if you'd like to read it, you can seek it out. Questions, too, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, on this final voyage, he goes across the Atlantic, goes by Iceland, around the southern tip of Greenland, finds his way into the Hudson Strait, what would be the Hudson Strait, and down into Hudson Bay. And I suppose that, and at this point, apparently he decided, well, he wanted to go on. It was getting into the winter. He knew that he would essentially have to hunker down for the winter and then would go on later. So he made the decision that he would winter there. He could have, I suppose, have at that point said, okay, we've gotten this far. We've kind of got some sense of the territory. Let's go back. And next year in the spring, the summer, when it's warmer, when we don't have to deal with ice, we'll come back. And I suppose it would be easy for us to say he made a bad choice here, but do you think he made a bad choice in deciding to stay there for the winter?
Well, in retrospect, it seems fairly clear that he made a bad choice because, you know, by deciding to stay there, he, you know, contributed to whatever, you know, hostilities were already sort of circulating on the ship, these sort of murmurings. There's hints in the documents that they started earlier, and that Hudson had people air their grievances before making the decision, you know, to stay there. But he understood, I mean, it, you know, it's funny, you know, we look at it and we say, well, okay, there was this mutiny, obviously things went bad, Hudson dies, it was a mistake. But Hudson, or someone on that ship, maybe the ship carpenter staff, people on that ship understood how to survive an Arctic winter. I mean, there's so much that has to take place for all of a crew or most of a crew to survive a winter. And Hudson and his men have the story, you know, already know what happened to the last Barents expedition, in which Barents himself dies and a number of men die, and some, only a few of them, make it back home. He knows that the ship is going to be encased in ice, but, you know, these are wooden ships, and if you don't do the right things, presumably sort of punching holes in the hull to relieve some of the pressure, the ice will crush the ship, and the ship won't be seaworthy the next year. Well, we know that the Discovery was seaworthy since it makes it back to London, so they handled that task perfectly as far as we know. They have to figure out a way to survive the winter in what are going to be a very difficult circumstance, and Hudson makes, you know, this goes back to sort of the lack of their geographical knowledge. Hudson makes what I think is the smartest calculation. He says to himself, I'm going to sail as far south as I can, because he's going on a European climate model, which says basically the climate will be the same at whatever latitude you are. Well, he gets to 52 degrees, which is about the same latitude as London. Unfortunately, what Europeans don't have knowledge about is the knowledge of Arctic winds and the way that ice moves in Hudson's Bay or James Bay, where he actually overwinters, as far as we can tell. Mm. And so he, you know, in that sense, he doesn't have the knowledge to make the perfect calculation, as going south didn't necessarily help him. But it wasn't a bad idea. And the fact that the document suggested only one man died over the course of the winter tells us that he did understand what he was doing. I mean, what his crucial mistake was not understanding the depth of hostility that some of these men felt for him when he chose not to go back to London, when he chose to stay. But in terms of achieving his goals, this goes back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier about succeeding. If he's saying to himself, okay, the ship is going to get iced in, what is the best way for me finally to make it to the Spice Islands? Well, logic could suggest that the best way is do everything I can to preserve the crew, everything I can to preserve the ship, and when it all thaws, look at the head start I have on the next year. I can spend much more time exploring in the next summer, and if for some reason it doesn't work out then, I can't find the passage, I'll still have time to get home. So it wasn't, you know, in retrospect, again, unfortunate, but at the time, I don't think irrational.
Mm. Well, then it seems that you have to give him credit for getting as far as he did, for getting himself and all these men through the winter. Then seems that the problem came in the spring when the ice broke and there was possibility to go home. And most of the crew, apparently, that's exactly what they wanted to do. And he said, no, we're not going back to London. We're going to continue to go west.
Exactly. And this is where, you know, this is where the historian, so me in this case, you know, this is where we have problems, because there is a single narrative that survives from this journey, which tells the basic story. And it's an incredible, literally incredible tale. And parts of it seem almost unbelievable. But in that narrative, left by this man named Abacuc Prickett, one of the people who eventually makes it back to London, he does tell this tale about this division, about this division in the crew, and then they get rid of Hudson. They get rid of some men who Prickett writes were infirm. They were injured. They were ill. You know, it's not entirely clear from the documents what's wrong with these people. And the idea is that they will try to preserve their provisions and, you know, just among the healthy people. So Hudson, you know, doesn't get the sense of the depth of this animosity toward him, at least as Prickett sells it. And then Prickett spins this tale that, yes, most of the men or some of the men had decided to come home, even though that meant a mutiny, and even though the presumed consequences of that, if they survived, would be that they would be hanged when they got home, although Prickett then provides an explanation for maybe how they could get out of it.
Yeah.
But it's this, he does, had Hudson, if Prickett is telling the truth about everything, and I think he tells the truth about most things, if Prickett is telling the truth about everything, it does seem clear that in June, that maybe in June of 1611, Hudson could have said, okay, let's go home, and the Discovery would have made it back with most of its crew intact, but he makes a different decision.
And then what makes it even more complicated, or what makes it a little bit more complicated, is that some of the mutineers didn't survive the voyage home. So by the time that the survivors got home, I think there were eight.
Yes, I mean, this is what makes, this is really the sort of incredible part of the account. Yeah, eight of them make it home. So just to go over sort of the basic math of the journey, there are 24 people on this ship when it leaves London, two of whom are boys. One of those boys, it's Hudson's son John. Another is a ship's boy. There were often boys on these ships for various reasons. One man, it proves to be troublesome while they're still off the coast of England, so they get rid of him. Now they're down to 23. Over the course of the winter, the ship's gunner dies. Now they're down to 22. Again, two of whom are boys and 20 are men, including Hudson. Then there is this rebellion, this mutiny, in which the purported mutineers, according to Prickett, tie Hudson up and his son, and put a number of the so-called infirm men on this very little boat called a shallop. And the ship carpenter, who is a very sort of heroic type in the narrative, decides he's loyal to Hudson, so he's going to go along with Hudson also. So in the end, there are nine of them on the shallop, which leaves basically, the others to go back. As they're starting to sail back, and this is the part of the narrative, you know, in which I think many historians and people read over time are just skeptical about, although it works in some sense. As they're going back, the crew on the Discovery sees a group of Inuit on the shore waving to them. They know by this point from all sorts of encounters between indigenous Americans and European sailors that these kinds of meetings typically were for trade. It's quite possible, you know, that these English had some experience with this, and so five of the men on the ship go paddle over to see these Inuit. For reasons the English don't understand, the Inuit purportedly turn on them, mortally wound four of the five, who struggle back to the ship. And then, very important for the larger narrative, they die on the ship, but they bleed to death basically on the decks, which is important for explaining why there's blood on the ship when it gets home.
Mm-hmm.
Then, as they're sailing to the North Atlantic, another man dies, presumably of starvation, possibly scurvy, we don't know. And then the incredible part, they make it back out to make a terrible thing for men and his son and the mathematician and the carpenter. They're all gone. But amazingly, you know, God has sort of stepped in and killed all the mutineers. None of us had anything to do with it.
How convenient.
Yeah, exactly. How convenient, right? And that's why this is like sort of almost a joke at the core of the whole narrative, right? It's like, you have got to be kidding. But the survivors immediately go in front of the Masters of Trinity House, which is a guild that had been set up by Henry VII to sort of take care of English ships abroad. And the Master of Trinity House are thinking, you know, what's going on? And they spin out the story, and there's some speculation that maybe a couple of these guys go to jail, but they're in jail very briefly if they're there at all, because some of them are back out exploring the North Atlantic the next year. And then a few years later, suspicion is still, you know, circulating in England, and so a number of them survivors are then deposed by the High Court of Admiralty, which eventually brings charges against four of them. One of the things about the book that I found most interesting, you know, going into it and reading the documents, you know, from the time, is I was just presumed that they would be charged with mutiny. But mutiny is not against the law. So eventually they're charged with exposing Hudson, leading to his death. So they're charged with murder, and they're acquitted. And so we have this story, which seems implausible when Prickett tells it. None of us had anything to do with the mutiny. But two separate tribunals in London, of the most learned people, the Masters of Trinity House and the High Court of Admiralty, they can't prove that any of these men had anything to do with it. And that's why, when it comes full circle, Prickett's story seems fairly plausible, even though it has this one implausible moment at the heart of it.
Yeah, it's given some of the stories that we know of famous mutinies, I'm sure people would be surprised that these men weren't hung. When did mutiny become a hanging offense?
1689. It becomes an offense then in order to suppress insurrection among the king's troops, really on land. To say that they couldn't be charged with mutiny is correct, but ever since the 1530s, there had been statutes, laws in England, which said basically that if anyone commits piracy, that's a hanging offense. And I went back to that because I was trying to figure out why the High Court of Admiralty and the depositions which survived, they keep saying to them, were these people intending to become pirates? I thought, what a curious thing to say. I mean, we don't have the sense of pirates in the North Atlantic. You know, the English have a sense of pirates, you know, off the coast of Africa, and they're terrified by pirates. And these Barbary pirates are kidnapping English sailors, and they're selling them into slavery within the Muslim world. And there's this real fear of that. But so piracy, I think, is what, you know, I would infer, you know, the courts kind of wanted to charge them with, but they had no proof of that. All they have are the depositions of the testimony of these men, who by the time the court starts taking them, which is 6 years after they're home, you know, they've had time to get their story straight, or maybe they're just telling the truth, you know. So it's a very interesting sort of problem to piece together.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Peter Mancall. He is professor of history and anthropology at University of Southern California and is author of the book Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson. It's published by Basic Books. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, if indeed the truth of the story is what this one man had said, is that what they did was they took Hudson, his son, and some other men, and put them in this little boat and gave them what they could in the manner of some food and some tools so that they could try to take care of themselves.
And a gun.
and then set them off. What does anybody think, and assuming that the blood on the deck was not Henry Hudson's, what are some of the maybe most compelling sort of stories that we might tell about what his ultimate fate was?
Well, in the book, you know, I tell what I think happened. Now, I mean, other scholars, other people looked at it, you know, might disagree. So let's assume that the narrative is correct. That is, that the story that they're put on the shallop and they're cut off, you know, from the Discovery, and they sail and they paddle away. They actually erect a little sail and sail away, and the Discovery goes up and eventually makes it back to England. So assuming that's true, then what are the scenarios that survive? Okay, so one scenario would be that they rig up this little shallop and basically follow the discovery and sail through the North Atlantic and make it back home. And a number of modern writers have suggested that this is, in fact, quite possible. And I don't doubt that it was possible, but I think it unlikely, because I think Hudson is calculating his best chances, and I think Hudson would have understood that it would have been risky in this little boat, even if theoretically he could survive the journey. And I think Hudson probably knew that when Sir Martin Frobisher explored the North Atlantic in the 1570s, five men were left behind, and they were never seen again. The English actually assumed that Inuit had killed and probably consumed them. What probably happened to them is they probably tried to sail home and were lost to the sea, the devouring sea, the promoter Richard Hakluyt called it. So one scenario would be that they could have tried to get home on the shallop. I don't think that happened. A second scenario would be that they met and somehow became integrated with a group of indigenous people, either Inuit along the sides of Hudson Bay or Cree along what is now James Bay. Hudson had, in fact, been trying to meet with any locals during the winter. He meets one Cree man who they trade with, and apparently they annoy a bit because Hudson thinks the Cree man's going to come back the next day, and he doesn't come back again. So one scenario would be that native peoples took them in. This is plausible, but we have no evidence that this happened, although there has been speculation for generations that Hudson's son was somehow adopted by some of these indigenous people. But again, there's no evidence for this. And that leads to the third scenario, which is the one that I sort of tease out in the book, which is that Hudson and his men decide to set up a camp. They could, I think, pretty easily have survived the summer. They had the skills to do so. And they would have set up a camp with the idea, and this is where I think, you know, I'm trying to read Hudson's psychology, you know, hundreds of years later. I think Hudson believed that the English would send ships to find him. And so what he would have wanted to do was to establish himself somewhere, presumably near a coastline, where he could be seen. And he, you know, he would be rescued the next year. Now, what's interesting about this scenario is that it could have happened. That is, we know that when ships start exploring this region again, that is in 1612, when ships start coming back again, a couple of the people on those ships are veterans of Hudson's voyage. And those men quite likely, one would think, had the best idea of where they might find him. The fact that they don't find him suggests that either they're not looking for him very hard or, you know, Hudson has disappeared at this point.
Now, you might understand why they wouldn't want to look for him very hard.
That is exactly right. You've gotten right to the heart of it, right? Because Hudson might say, what do you mean? These guys were in on the mutiny. They should be hanged. So then we have little bits of evidence when Thomas James, an English captain, explores in the area in the 1630s. He finds these sharpened stakes in the ground. And archaeologists could debate, you know, that maybe these were left by Cree Indians. I think that's plausible in many ways. But I also think it's possible from the description we have in the account that these stakes were sharpened by English hatchets. We don't know. I mean, goods are moving through the North Atlantic, so it's kind of hard to figure out. But it's possible they were shaped by English hatchets. There are these two stakes near the shoreline, which might have been a place where an English person would sort of tie up a ship. I mean, the Cree and the Inuit use these very lightweight kayaks and would not have had as much reason to have these stakes in the ground. So maybe he was there. And then I think the more interesting evidence is an English explorer named Thomas Gorst, who's in the area in 1670-71, overwinters in James Bay just like Hudson does. He becomes friends with, or at least trading partners with, the local Cree Indians. He studies the Cree Indians. He sees how they live. This is very important because after the ice thaws on Gorst in 1671, he gets in a little shallop and decides, oh, I'm going to paddle around, do some last-minute exploring before we set off back to England. Comes onto an island, sees this ruin of a dwelling that he says came across a house not of Indian construction. This must be where poor Hudson died. And I think that's a really fascinating, you know, bit of evidence. It's never been found by archaeologists, so we can't say, aha, here's where it is. Gorse did not say precisely where it was. But I think that, you know, the rest of Gorse's narrative is pretty truthful sounding. And so my sense is that maybe he did stumble upon a place where Hudson and his men had set up, it was probably a winter quarters, what would have been the winter of 1611, 1612. And then I tease out what I think happened to them during that winter.
Yeah. Back in London, so when the survivors came back and they told the story, I'm sure that people could react to it in a variety of ways. How did they think of Hudson? And did they think that he indeed was a victim of his own bad judgment? Did they think that he was just a victim of bad luck, that he was a victim of a bad crew? What did people think?
Well, as far as we can tell, Hudson was held in pretty high esteem by people back in England. I mean, the authorities, you know, when the authorities, when the High Court of Admiralty decides to bring charges against these survivors, it is, and they don't explain why, or if they did, the documents don't survive, but I, you know, presumably it is because people have been talking about what happened to Hudson. I mean, here you have a guy who documented a journey to, you know, up to the Arctic, documented two attempts to go through the Northeast Passage, documented this trip across the Atlantic Ocean in 1609, a guy who could really handle a lot of things, a guy who was worthy of support from some of the most prominent investors in England at the time, including Sir Thomas Smith, who ends up in the 1610s sort of rescuing the Virginia Company from its financial desperation, a very important financier. He is, you know, Hudson's, you know, one of Hudson's prime backers. I mean, I think there is a sense that Hudson is an important person and someone who is sort of, you know, it was a lingering mystery that had to be solved. I mean, I think that's what sort of prompted this case. The English in the 1610s are sending expeditions in the same area where Hudson went, and out of that comes the very famous explorer Thomas Baffin, William Baffin, you know, who names Baffin Bay. I mean, a very important figure in English overseas exploration. So that's going on. At the same time, the English are sending ship after ship, you know, down into the Mediterranean. They're being raided by Barbary pirates, and the English are sort of thinking, how can we better assert ourselves on the seas? I mean, this is kind of the moment, if you want sort of a moment, where the English are beginning to conceptualize in a kind of specific way, you know, how to create a maritime empire. I mean, historians would debate the actual origins of the empire, but there are certain things going on in the early years of the 17th century about how can this island nation, which doesn't have a huge amount of natural resources, how can it assert itself against other Europeans? And then under Elizabeth and then under James, it was the added thing about how can this Protestant nation assert itself against these Catholic nations? And so I think what's going on in the 1610s is a sense of, you know, this nation finding what would, you know, sort of at the beginning of trying to, of finding what its great national purpose would be, which would be to create this enormous empire. And Hudson is sort of a key figure in that. They need to find out. And so I think, you know, we can look in the documents, and as a historian, I look in the documents and I say, boy, this guy was incredibly stubborn. And if he just said, okay, I'll go back to England, everything would be fine. But I think to people in the 17th century, he is a noble, brave explorer. The accounts about him are sort of, you know, about the tragedy, you know, of Hudson. I mean, I think he is held by most people, most English people, in very high esteem. I think their way of sensing, you know, the value of an individual is very different than ours today.
Mm-hmm. People after him continued to do this, tried to find this route by water across North America from the Atlantic to the Pacific. And one way of bringing the story up to where we are now that I think is really fascinating is that apparently as a result of global warming, there are people who think that actually it's possible that there is a Northwest Passage much further north through the Arctic, but that in fact now, because of melting, that things are opening up and you may indeed be able to do it.
That is exactly right. Poor Hudson was four centuries too early. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the change, I mean, actually, one of the really important lessons, you know, that historians or others can learn from these documents is we have a sense of what the Arctic was like before global warming. You know, and Hudson describes a world very different, you know, from what's going on there now. And if you read, I mean, Elizabeth Colbert, who's this brilliant, you know, writer about the Arctic, you know, her tales of how, you know, how the Arctic is changing because of global warming. You know, you read them and think, oh, this is just incredible. But yes, had Hudson gone much later because of human, because of the changes that humans have made to the environment, theoretically he could have made it through. By not making it through, he is telling us a lot about sort of the aspirations of his time and also about the physical world that he inhabited, a world which is often hard to, you know, sort of recreate or understand. But yeah, global, it is one of sort of the ironies of the whole thing that now in our world, that is, so it's on the 400th anniversary of Hudson going to New York, you know, this seems possible, whereas on the 300th anniversary, 100 years ago of Hudson going to New York, this, of course, still would have been a fantasy.
Yeah. What do you think is the appeal of a story like this? Certainly, stories like this do have great appeal.
Well, I think Hudson is a great character. I mean, in a sort of a classic, you know, sort of literary sense. You know, I wish I knew a lot more about him. I wish I knew what he looked like. You know, all of the portraits that you see are all posthumous. Who knows if he looked like any of the things that you see? So all those and I don't use any of those portraits, you know, in my book because they're all just whatever, fantasies on some level. But I think here you have one of these sort of classic explorer narratives of the individual driven to find new knowledge. I mean, what I like about Hudson is Hudson brings together so much of this period, this kind of, you know, as I was talking about, England looking for its place in the world, the desire for spices and what it meant, a nation sort of coming to terms with being an island, you know, power, a maritime power. You know, and one of the other things I like about Hudson, some of them are, you know, when we teach our students and our kids and students about early America, you know, we talk about Columbus, and then we kind of skip over to Jamestown. Maybe we make a little stop on Roanoke. But what Hudson tells us is that when it comes to English colonization of North America, failure was more common in the early period than success. And that's a very sort of humbling thing that we, you know, might need to, which I think it's good to remember. Mm-hmm. So, and the people who are figuring that out are these explorers, these people who are, you know, willing to risk all. And I often tell people this, you know, when Hudson goes out in 1610, he's there with his 17-year-old son. I have a 17-year-old son. This is not why I wrote the book, but I have a 17-year-old son, and I cannot for the life of me imagine saying to him, hey, I'm going to go explore again this year. Why don't you come along? Oh, yeah, you might not make it back, right? I mean, he has this drive and this determination, and there is this kind of, because we know what happens, there's this kind of tragic element to it. It's almost, you know, sort of like watching, you know, sort of a Shakespearean tragedy. You know it's going to end badly, and yet you're going to learn so much about the nature of sort of human character and struggle in the process. I mean, he's just an incredible character in that sense.
Well, the story is told in the book, Fatal Journey, The Final Expedition of Henry Hudson. It's published by Basic Books by our guest, Peter Mancall. He is professor of history and anthropology at the University of Southern California. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Support for the program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. WILO thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. That's it for us here on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host, and she'll be with you for the rest of the afternoon.
Thank you very much, David. And coming up this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we'll talk about the Great Books of the Western World, a collection of 443 works in 54 volumes. We'll go to the archives. We'll rebroadcast an interview about the Great Books with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam, author of A Great Idea at the Time, The Rise, Fall, and Curious Afterlife of the Great Books. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. In Kansas City, September wheat is trading at 550. That's down 11 and a half. December, 566 and three quarters, down 11. Chicago, September, 517, down 14 and three quarters. December, 543 and three quarters, down 15 and a quarter. September corn, 316 and a quarter, down 10 and three quarters. December, 327 and three quarters, down 11. March, 340 and three quarters, down 11 and a half. May, 350 and a half, down 11. August soybeans, 10.21 and 3 quarters, down 1 and 3 quarters. September, 9.53 and 3 quarters, down 7 and 3 quarters. November, 9.18, down 14. January, 9.25, down 14 and a quarter. August meal, 3.22.60, down